Welcome, everybody. You know what it is. Orale Boa Heights, coming at you from Espacio 1839 here in Boa Heights. Unfortunately, not from radioespacio.org. This heat has been taking its casualties, and some of the tech equipment in the Espacio recording booth is one of those casualties in terms of things are not working. So I have a very different setup today. I have like a little portable Zoom microphone connected to my laptop, recording via GarageBand. Super simple setup, but it works. But you can also, if you're a regular listener, you can tell the difference in terms of the sound. There's a lot more echo. This little microphone picks a lot. Like, I don't know if you can hear, like, somebody's, like, moving around outside the studio. So you can hear that. Like, it even, like, picked up, like, some, like, kid passing by in a skateboard.
Cool.
So hopefully, you know, I'll work out the kinks for this in the after post-production of the show. But as always, this is episode 11. As always, nothing but super-duper awesome guest. Please introduce yourself.
Hey, what's up? I'm Daniel Hernandez, and I'm here with El Random Hero.
Yeah. Thank you for coming.
Of
I mean,
course.
He's kind of on a timer too, because some folks have been here before. You got to go feed the meter. So at some point, we're going to take a break, and hopefully the transition's seamless. But thanks again for coming, man. I know you got so much going on. There's always work going on, you know, especially the job with an editor, so it's like nonstop, and I'm sure you just want to hang out in somewhere that's air conditioning too.
I'm glad to be here. Actually, it's always great to come to Boyle Heights and engage with people here. Yes, I'm doing LATaco.com now, and that's kind of my main gig for the past 6 months. I've been bouncing around a lot, but now I think we're in a groove. And so, you know, want to invite all your listeners to check out LA Taco.
Yeah, that's part of the reason why I invited you. I myself have been writing for LA Taco for a number of years.
Yeah,
so I mean, I haven't been as active on it the last few years as I should be. But then that's also more of me and deciding to focus on my own, like, personal stuff that I got going on. Kind of like this podcast, too. But before we get started, I did want to let folks know about this other little side project that I have going on with the podcast that I put out on social media. And that I became self-aware that I should stop putting my ideas out on social media so then other people can steal them. But kind of laying claim to it is a while back, I posted on Facebook, Twitter, that I wanted to do like a little sub-podcast from what I'm doing now, which is basically I just talk to anybody who wants to talk about like the old school Chicano hood East LA movies. And we just talk about them like the same way a lot of us have talked about them in terms of when we see them with folks, with friends, with families, especially with a lot of people who were like, you've never seen that movie? We got to sit you down and watch this movie because it's, you know, it's
there's
the best.
There's a lot like that.
Yeah. So, you know, there's a huge list of these kind of movies from, you know, the most obvious of like Blood In, Blood Out, Born in East LA, Selena, even like the ones in the South Central, Boys in the Hood, Menace to Society. So I put that call out, and a few folks already like said, hey, I'm down for that. Here's the movie I want to talk about. So I'm just putting it out there, keeping myself accountable. This is something that's going to be happening in the works in the future. So something to look out for, especially now that I have this little more mobile setup between my computer and an extra microphone. Since I only have 2 hours here at Espacio, sometimes that's more than I need and sometimes that's less than I need. So I'm really just trying to, like, almost a year into this, really trying to get into it and, like, figure things out and be more productive and do more with the show. But Daniel's here. You can find him on social media, especially on Twitter, at Long Drive South. So let's get with that. You're from San Diego.
I am from San Diego. It's like the biggest like thing that people have to say about me when I'm in LA. That's why I don't want to be a LA person. I have a 619 number because
keep it. Like some folks hung on to like their 213 number.
I know, but it sometimes feels weird to be editor of LA Taco and have a 619 number. Actually, I have, and in a lot of ways, people don't care about that. But
how was it growing up in San Diego for you? Because I just realized this the other day when I was like looking up info on you. You're only 4 years older than me, but you're already getting up there. I can see some of that gray bush.
Yeah, I see some on your, como se dice, aquí en tu,
on my side,
on your side. Yeah, and I'm all white here, and I started losing hair up here when I was like 26.
Oh damn. the gene,
it's the brain. San Diego, I think, is deeply misunderstood. You know,
I've only been there once.
Really?
Yeah. That's mostly just because I was scared of all these years of, like, now, like, why would I want to go somewhere where, like, the migra is closer to where I am?
Yeah, totally. And plus, there is that, the checkpoint, which are mostly unmanned. In the past 2-3 years that I've been back from Mexico, because I used to live in Mexico City. That's what I was going to say. I have my 619 number because I lost all my 323 numbers after living 8 years in Mexico. So the minute I got back, my dad was like, I'm going to get you a cell phone if you move back, and I'm going to help you buy a car, because my parents were so desperate to have me move back.
Oh, they missed you.
They missed me, and they were just like, Mexico's too wild and too dangerous. And
I mean, that's some of the stuff I wanted to get into. You were covering some of the shit that was really popping off, like with the Chapo, the murders in Tanapa. So, I mean, there's a lot of shit going on.
I think I needed to come back to L.A., and in L.A. specifically, because that's where I really formed myself professionally. Because it was just getting too hectic. But we can talk about that in a minute. I mean, I don't know. San Diego's like, it's a city, you know? It's like Long Beach. It's like San Jose. It's like Fresno. It's like...
It has its own vibe going on. Folks have their own struggles there. Because the first time I did go was maybe a year ago. And it was for work. And it was a bus ride. There was a tour between like the organizations that my job is a part of, so kind of like, hey, come down to San Diego, we'll give you a tour of the projects that we're working on, and we'll like introduce you to like some of the community members. And that was also one of my first time going to Chicano Park and learning about the history of the park as well.
Yeah, Chicano Park is amazing.
So I was like, damn, there's like kids skating over there. There was the amazing murals, and at the time, I forgot when we were there, but it was just recent. Where like maybe a month or two when I was there, before that, where it was like somebody was drunk and they like crashed their truck and like flipped over. So I was like, I didn't know that was like a common thing.
That it was not a common thing. It was pretty scary when that happened and pretty sad when that happened. It was a military guy who was on his way back to Coronado, and there was some kind of a festival or something going on there.
Yeah, there's always something going on.
There's always something going on. The big day, of course, is Chicano Park Day. It's every April. And it's around the time of Earth Day. But Chicano Park is an affirmation for the community, a space that was denied us and that the community took over and occupied, one of the earliest such movements. I'm from City Heights. Well, we grew up close to Barrio Logan in like Southeast, which was like a more mixed black-brown neighborhood. Then we moved to City Heights, which was also kind of mixed black-brown. And then we moved to Southeast San Diego. So kind of move basically around all the hoods of the city of San Diego. All
right.
When you meet people from San Diego and they say they're from San Diego, usually when you ask them, it's like usually North County, something like Escondido, Oceanside, some of the ritzier, wider areas, I guess. And I happen to be from the city, and I think we're very proud that we're from city of San Diego. But my identity is also very much Tijuana, because my parents are from Tijuana. Both my parents are from Tijuana. My grandparents are from Tijuana. And so we're very much like a TJ family in San Diego, but from birth, if that makes any sense.
It's so close.
It's like right there.
It's just like drive down. Let's go down there.
I mean, literally like tomorrow I'm going to be in TJ, you know.
Oh, wow.
Nice.
Are you just visiting for fun?
We have to like take my little sister just had baby girls, twin girls.
Oh, okay.
And so I'm going with my mom, very Theo, to take, and the family to take, the girls to the TJ family that can't cross into San Diego. So some of our relatives cruzan y otros no, you know, so it's like we go and we do two of everything for both sides of the family. The family that's like divided by the border, I guess. And so that's
nice. So it's like, hey, we have babies, you should come meet the babies.
Yeah. we'll bring food. Them to you.
Yeah.
So it's always fun, you know.
Nice. As I'm getting older, I'm appreciating like family, because when I was younger I was like, get away from me. But now I was like, alright, in intervals, you're alright.
Yeah, totally. Same here.
Oh man, were there gangs when you were growing up? Like, yes. What was like some of the mobiles going on?
I grew up in the 90s, you know, I graduated from high school in 1998, you know, and So I think gangs were always a threat through middle school, I guess, in terms of the threat of, you know, being drawn into the gangs or getting on the wrong side. And also, like, taggers and tagger crews and, like, tag banging and all that. That was really big when I was little. It was also
starting as well, yeah.
You know, so it's like all of my brothers were, like, taggers, I guess. One of my brothers was in a gang. Was in ESD, the gang in City Heights in East San Diego. So he was in state prison for several years because of it, or related to that. We have had sort of, I guess, casualties to, like, 90s California gang, or I guess just what, you know, we were in a couple of drive-bys now that I think about it. Like,
it's that fireworks or gunshots?
Yeah, I mean, just some real, it did have sort of its real period, I guess. And most people in LA don't know about that.
I
don't know how else to sort of communicate that without trying to come off like you're trying to be hard or you're trying to front or you're trying to rep somebody to shit. It was just kind of a reality and a sort of subtext to our life and that we emerge from and that our family is more cohesive now after we're able to survive that. But many of our friends were shot and killed while growing up or went to prison forever or became Victory Outreach, crazy evangelical Christians.
We have one down the street.
Exactly. So it's like kind of like if you grew up in that period, unless you were a major nerd like I was and I managed to succeed in school and do all that, you were either going to be drawn into one of these paths because the school to prison pipeline thing was a very much real thing. And I remember I even had like a Raza counselor who was like, yeah, you just need to go to 2 years, you know, and just...
community college.
Yeah, he was just, like, trying to pipe me into community college, which is very difficult to get out of.
Why do you want to go over there? Too much money. Exactly. You're going to, like, get into debt.
And it's like, we still have adults from the movement telling our youth this. It's not, you know, yes, it's a struggle. But I also feel very fortunate that I grew up in extremely multiracial, multicultural, multiethnic neighborhoods. And then I really realized how important that was for me personally after I moved to LA, because LA is, you know, relatively more segregated.
That's what a lot of people realize.
To put it in very like mild terms. And honestly, my experience in San Diego wasn't like that. And so I found it somewhat constricting actually when I moved to LA. And the degree to which things are racialized here and every interaction is racialized, that's not the experience that I had growing up. And I find it very unsettling that LA has kind of that chip on its shoulder in a lot of ways.
I mean, I didn't even think about that until like one of my first experiences getting out of the neighborhood, literally like going to another state. Like the first time I flew in an airplane, I went to DC for like an internship, and you know, you just kind of like, dang. I mean, you miss some things from home, like tortillas and like all this like stuff that you're used to. But then you really do realize how segregated you are, because you have to explain to folks where you live and where is that relative to like other popular tourist sites like Hollywood, the beach, all this other stuff. It's like, no, we never, like, I was just recently in New Orleans and I had to explain to folks, like, oh, you live in LA? Like, do you go here? It's like, nope, I never go anywhere near that part of town because it's too far.
Right.
You know, my kind isn't welcome there. Like, what business do I have doing there? It's just, you know,
it's rough. So I think when I got to LA, I very much challenged myself to get out of my comfort zones and to reach out as much as I could to every part of the city and really treat the city like my own, because I've always felt very adopted here and very welcome here. And I think it was the same experience that I had in Mexico City. Like, everyone has their own geographies and everyone has their own cartographies that matter to them, that they've created and built, especially in cities as massive as Los Angeles, where you can't go from one side to the other in half a day without really planning it and really taxing yourself in many ways. San Diego being a much smaller city, we were able to get around very quickly around it. But yeah, we hardly, you know, we did go to the beach because my mom was like, our asses live near the beach, we're going to the beach. But she would take us to the widest possible beach in America, which is Coronado. Coronado Beach, on the other side of Chicano Park, one of the wealthiest areas in the United States.
Yeah.
And it's actually, many of the new homeowners are very wealthy white Mexicans, but growing up, we went to that beach. It wasn't our closest beach. We should have gone to the Hood Beach, which was Imperial Beach, which in the 80s and 90s was a very cholo-ass beach and a very, like, hippie-ass beach.
And it's like we could end up going to Long Beach here.
Exactly. So my mom would literally go out of her way to drive us to the white beach and the surfers. They would yell at us to go back to Mexico, like
locals only,
shit like that. When I'm like, now, you know what I'm saying, like while I'm alive, you know. But it, I think it was very important for me. It was that lesson that I picked up from my mom was, the city is yours, the beach is yours, this fucking beach is every much your beach as Imperial Beach or the beaches where the Mexicans hang out.
Like, don't anybody tell you otherwise.
Exactly. And I think that was really important and something that I took to heart. And anywhere I go, like, there is no reason to feel unwelcome or uncomfortable anywhere, because my ass is from here, my blood is from here, my roots are here. I go back to this fucking part of the world from the beginning of time and since before that line was there. So I'm not uncomfortable. If you're uncomfortable with my presence, well, that's your issue.
Your problem,
yeah. You know, than mine. And so I think I was able to... And also, just because I'm a journalist, I'm curious, and I'm always trying to just see new shit and move new shit.
What's going on.
You know what I mean? But it's not easy in Los Angeles, especially in this kind of a city where people are very sort of, in a way, provincial in their geographies, in the sense that...
Territorial.
It is very difficult to get out of your little zone. You know, you have to really make an effort. Like, now, maybe we're going to reach a point in New York where you can hop on a train in an hour.
We're getting there.
It's going to take 30, 40 more years or whatever and a lot of hurt. But, you know, we're not quite there yet.
No, yeah. 2020, the new station in Little Tokyo, that's like going to be like one of the crowning achievements, because once that's built, you'll be able to get from the Gold Line and transfer at that station to the Expo Line and go directly to the beach.
Yeah.
No more like Santa Monica Blue Bus, no more 720 Metro Rapid. Just, you get on the train, maybe like a 40-minute hour train ride, pending delays and stuff like that, yeah. And you're there, yeah.
What is up with those delays on ATA?
I've been like, the last 2 years I've been driving, so I'm like, I don't even care about Metro anymore, but I still yell at them on social media. But when I was like active on public transportation on a daily basis, so my commute, for folks who don't know, is my job is in South Central and I live in Boyle Heights. So
where in South Central?
Off Florence and Western.
Okay.
So on my bike, that's about a 40-minute hour bike ride, depending how I feel that day, 12, 13 miles. Driving, between 30 to 45 minutes, you know, with traffic, depending what side streets I take, where I get on the freeway. And via public transportation, the best I could do was 90 minutes, and the worst I could do was 2 hours.
Okay.
And it's because of the combination of, like, I'm in Boyle Heights, so I'll do a combination of, like, I'll get on the Gold Line, transfer to the Red, transfer to the Expo, get on a bus, and then get to my office. Or I used to take the Montebello 40 that goes down all of 4th Street, the 4th Street Bridge, and then catch the Expo line in 7th Street. But
so there isn't a clear line to
there
get
isn't
there.
A clear line. Yeah, and then once they close the 6th Street Bridge for demolition and for construction, that just created more pocket congestion. Like, don't even... If you've never been out in Boyle Heights trying to go west in the morning, don't ever go down to San Chavez. Don't ever go down 1st Street. And now, don't ever go down 4th, because each one has its own little characteristics of why there's so much traffic. You go down to San Chavez, you're going to hit Union Station traffic. You're going to go down 1st. There's only one traffic lane for that entire corridor between Boyle, and by the time you get to Mission to cross the bridge. On 4th, there's multiple entrances and exits for the freeway, and now there's like almost multiple signal lights over every other stop, and they're not synchronized, so traffic is just stalling and stopping, you know, for going this way, going the other way, for people turning, and then like going around in circles.
What about Soto all the way to Washington or whatever?
That's what I do now. So I'll go down 4th, go down Soto, go down to Whittier, and then make a left, and then take the detour on 7th all the way over the bridge, and then make a left on Santa Fe, and then get on the freeway.
Yeah.
So it's like I've had to figure this out.
That's cool. I like that route, though.
Nobody take my route. That's going to be more traffic for me. But essentially, it's once the bridge closed down, you had like this massive pileup of congestion and like all these things going on. And with Metro themselves, the other thing I learned too, and I felt guilty about this, is even to the day when I take Metro, and I recommend this to anybody, is go to the Metro Alerts Twitter feed.
Okay.
That's the constant feed where they're giving updates on delays and,
right,
you know, what's going on this bus or that train or what have you. And a lot of the times the delays were because somebody got hurt.
Yeah.
Yeah, like the one of the biggest
suicides
one,
or act people.
It was a combination of a lot of things. Like one of the ones that really hit me was a black woman who jumped off the ledges from the Compton, like one of the like Compton stations, because those are up really high.
On the Blue Line?
Yeah, so she just jumped off and that caused delays because I'm like, where the hell is
my
train?
Did she die?
She died.
Was she hit by a train or was she electrocuted?
I can't remember. Well, this is light train, so like anything above the ground is just light and there's no third electric rail.
Okay.
But even like just recently there was a guy here on the Soto station who something happened, he must have passed out or something and it fell over the tracks and then got hit, got run over by a train.
Damn.
So he's suing Metro because he says it could have been prevented because he was laying on the tracks for like a good 11 minutes and nobody did anything.
Okay, so, well, get off the tracks, bro. Like, the fuck?
Well, he said he hit himself, his head on the rail. Oh, at least that's what the lawsuit says.
Well, he's alive.
He's alive, but, you know, not complete. Other times, it's that. It's like people, like, jumping on trains, suicide. More often than not, though.
In Mexico City, too, a lot of suicide by train.
Yeah, you know, it's in New York, I started tripping out when I learned more about that. It's but more often than not, it's people fighting on the trains.
Yeah.
Or, like, some sort
inside
of
the train.
Yeah. And I've seen this myself. Where, like, it's to the point now, and I don't know if you saw this video of this guy pulling out the black guy who had a seizure. So it's a lot of things of that where, like, the last time I was in a train and there was a fight, the whole train came together and, like, kind of, like, just unanimously agreed that we should get these two women who are fighting out of the train so our train isn't delayed and then they can handle what they need to handle.
So you guys pushed these two ladies out of the train?
Like, I wasn't anywhere near them, but, like, everybody who was around them was just like, yo, take that outside, get out of here, get out of here. And then it was only, like, one older white woman who was like, we need to do the right thing and stop this and call the conductor. So that would have meant the train would stop until the police got there and everything got sorted out. So it's like, everybody's like, and it was summer, too, so it was just this, like, wow. Like,
you know, I'm kind of glad to hear that those kinds of things happen in Los Angeles because it's good person-to-person stranger engagement that people don't have on a regular basis. Like, again, going back to the effort, because I did so much of my growing up there, really. Like, you would see so much fucked up shit on that subway. Like, there was... You saw, like, the best of humanity and the worst of humanity. And the times that I've used the train here in L.A., it's kind of the same thing, like someone taking a shit or like
something somebody doing they shouldn't be doing.
Some conversation, some arc, someone smelling really bad. Like, we need that shit in Los Angeles. Like, my sensation here is that people are so attached to home, car, work,
being separated
from someone that, like, in the FM, when you sit down next to someone and your knees are touching, it's people in LA like, hey, like, basically,
you're too close.
No, it's like, we're in a fucking city. We're on an overcrowded planet. You are going to have physical contact with a stranger. And, buddy, it's okay. Like, you will live. And that kind of, like, it was a real shock for me to come back after I had Mexicanized, so to speak, in a certain way, in terms of how my relationship to public space and to strangers in public space. I became used to, like, having that engagement. Bumping a shoulder with someone and it's not like a threat of violence or a fight or something to avoid.
Yeah, I've had that.
It's just something that happens, and sort of like that's the way cities work. And the more that we realize that and confront that, even though it can be very ugly sometimes in LA, I think that's good. If there was a collective action on that car that you described, well, that's a collective action that should probably be respected over the lady who wants to call the conductor. You know what I'm saying? Like, is it technically or by the rules the best thing to do? Maybe not. But this is a city. Everyone's fucking moving. Everyone's got somewhere to go. Like, let's do it.
No, I mean, one of my burned into my memory experiences was, like, I got on the bus and it was crowded. And I'm standing remotely holding to the top rack, face forwards to another. Kind of like the way we're sitting right now. I'm sitting in front of you, but on the bus I was standing. And the guy was just like, yo, dude, you need to get away from me because I just got out of prison and what you're doing is something that you would get your ass kicked for. So I was like, what does he mean? I was like, I'm not going to, like, question him or anything. I listened to him. He's like, yeah, I'm like, sorry about that. Let me get out of your way.
Bus, like...
Yeah, but, like, the situation was, like, he was sitting down. And, I mean, I'm not the tallest person in the world, but, like, in the proximity of his, you know, my crotch was in his face. So it's like, you need to get the fuck off of me before I do something about it. But that's one thing I appreciate, you know, it's this tough love and te pone las pilas, you know, sí. bien rápido, where you gotta right. learn how to interact with folks yeah. and very much de-escalate situations where like, oh, yeah. I'm sorry, I didn't know that, like, my bag hit you, you know. And it's funny because my girlfriend's from New York, and when, like, the first time I went there, I was like, I noticed, like, you're a jerk on public transportation. You're like, you're hitting people with your backpack as you're leaving. You don't even apologize.
You said to her?
Yeah, like, you're running to the bus, not because it's late, but because you want to get in front of all the older people and the kids and the mom who want to get a seat in the front because you want to take their seat. And then
she sounds like a good traveler.
Yeah, she's a New Yorker, like, through and through. But I'm like, I'm here on vacation. I'm here. Yeah. You know, on time, relaxing. I'm not in a hurry to get anywhere. The bus is there. Right. You know, I'm used to going to the back and giving my seat to other people.
Right.
But it's a trip. And I think, yeah, I mean, ever since I started driving now, I'm very conscious of that decision that I'm very distinctly separating myself from folks mm-hmm. and everything that's going on in the train.
And some people do it all day, every day for their whole lives and never question it.
Yeah.
You know.
And I did. I was like, screw this. I got yeah. DACA now.
I got DACA. Leave my ass alone.
It's basically so you were talking about that thug life, so you kind of got away with that because, you know, you were in school. Like, what was it about it? Did you get tracked into, like, magnet classes?
Yeah.
Did your parents, like, put you in those programs?
That was it. Like, my parents worked for the school district, so my dad was a counselor. I watched my dad get his master's degree.
Oh, wow, nice.
Actually, he got his undergrad at San Diego State, but my dad started out working in the fields in Central Valley. So it was really, when he first crossed. So at least it was very encouraging for us and for me and my brothers and sisters to see my dad get his education as an adult, become a counselor, become a full teacher. So he retired from San Diego City Schools, the district, and my mom was a librarian. My mom did not do schooling beyond sixth grade in Tijuana, you know, so it's like she tested for her GED, had never taken a high school course in her life, and tested out because she's an incredibly voracious reader and she reads a lot. So I picked that up, I think, from both my parents, and they moved us into the arts high school, Casa, what's it called here? Laxa? Like the L.A. County School of the Arts. Oh,
yeah, the one by the freeway on Grand.
Yeah, so it's like, I think it's at Cal State campus, too.
There is one over there, too.
Yeah, so I went to the Loxa of San Diego, basically, and it was the public school, the public magnet that your parents had to, like, fight to get you in.
Did you have to put somebody else's zip code?
No, we did for a little bit, but we did that time. But, you know, they put us on the waiting list when we were in, like, kindergarten, and I didn't get called up until, like, the sixth grade.
Oh, wow.
So that school, I think, was really helpful. You know, we all made it out. One of my brothers eventually was kicked out because he was slinging acid in the ninth grade, but then they let him back in. It's kind of things, and like, but I was just a nerd. I was so bookish, you know, and I was, you know, really into journalism for all my high school career. And
was there a school, like, high school newspaper?
There was a high school newspaper. I was editor of the high school newspaper, like a big nerd. I was editor 2 years in a row, like a massive nerd. And
it's like breaking rotten milk in the school. Top story today.
But even then, I was already messing with the powers. Like they tried to censor a couple of things that we tried to publish. We wrote very sort of like honest theater reviews, which maybe we shouldn't have done.
Yeah,
you know, like you know, a lot of. Then I think that's when I realized the power of the free speech and the written word, and that. Yes, you can say whatever the hell you want, but you have to be very responsible with it.
Yeah, should you be
saying that? And you have to understand and absorb the consequences of what you say and of your actions. And so, you know, I made someone cry because of an article that I wrote. And it was a class, it was of someone else in the high school. And that's when I was like, okay, buddy, like get your head out of your, like...
Like, you know, cry because it was a bad review?
Because it was a bad review.
Oh.
You know what I'm saying? And it's like... That's when I was like, began to very early on pick up these lessons. It's like, okay, do you really want to say that? Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, can you live with the consequences of what you write? And so I carry that with me even today. If I'm writing about someone, will they feel that they were treated fairly by my process and by my article, even if they disagree with what was said about them?
But at least it was respectful.
And at least you did the due diligence and the due process to ask all of the necessary questions to have a complete picture of what it is that you're talking about.
Because, I mean, you got to be objective. You got to get both sides of the picture. And then you, as the writer, sometimes you got to just be in the middle of it and present it to everybody.
Yeah.
And that's it.
Or sometimes you can decide and say, this is wrong and this is right, but after you've gathered enough information.
Yeah, so you were editor at the high school, and then you went to to Berkeley.
Yeah.
To Cal, what is it?
Cal Berkeley, UCB.
I was going to say Cal Arts for some reason.
No.
You went to Berkeley.
Little UC Berkeley. I had no idea what it was. When I applied for the UCs and Cal States, again, my counselor was saying go to, 2 year or whatever. But, I checked all the boxes on UC, and I applied to San Diego State and a couple others just because my dad had gone there. My family is very kind of associated with San Diego State.
It's the local school too.
The local school. It's a big school. You
get to live at home.
Yeah, you would go to the Mecha conferences there, the high school Mecha conferences. I was co-president of my high school Mecha. Nice. I was there.
It's funny when I hear about 90s Mecha. I always, depending who I hear it from, it was the greatest thing ever, or it was the most horrible thing ever because it was somebody that got excluded.
Yeah, it's very it's the Mecha kind of attitude, but in high school it's a little more chill. In college, then I went and saw Mecha at Berkeley, and I was like, whoa, these guys don't fuck around. I was very, I've always felt that you just kind of, you have to lay out the truth, and you can't be an agent for anyone. And so I remember one of the first articles that I did. So I got into Berkeley, and I got a scholarship to Berkeley. I never expected to do that. I thought at most I would go to UC San Diego. You know what I'm saying? Because our family's tight. There'd be no reason for us to leave. That's what my parents told me. There are great schools here, blah, blah. And I remember that I was getting recruited. I didn't even know that I was getting recruited, but I guess I would get calls and letters from Stanford and from Harvard and from Yale.
You'd be a prospect.
And I think I was a prospect for some of these places. And then I was just like, I don't know. No one was guiding me. My parents were too busy working. And I was the first person in the family, I guess, to get to that point. Although my older siblings were educated, but were educated separately because they kind of grew up separately a little bit.
Mm.
But anyway, so I went to Berkeley, and I decided to go, and I had to convince my parents to go because they offered me the most money, which was very, a blessing, But it was also a huge challenge for us because there would, again, as with a lot of Chicano students, Chicano Latino students, you want to stay close to home. What they did, there was current students, and I was admitted in the first class admitted without affirmative action.
Oh, wow.
So it was the year that our numbers at Cal dropped 80%, 60%, 93% drop in enrollment year to year for African Americans. It was bad.
Dang.
So it was a crisis, right? So they let us in, and there were current Raza students who invited the high school outgoing admit seniors to come up to campus and to live with them for 2 days, 2 nights. And so they flew a bunch of us up. A student organization raised money to fly us up to Berkeley, all the admits from California, the Latinos.
Do you remember the name of the organization?
The Raza Recruitment and Retention Center.
Oh, cool.
And I became RRRC. And I became one of
those folks. Young blood.
Because someone invited me in, and that was one of the best fucking weekends of my teenage years, man. Because they know what's up. They're Raza, they're Chicano, but they're also at Berkeley and working hard. I was so impressed by the kids that I met, the already students, because they were some of the most hardcore partiers that I had ever met.
And it's business, here's where the school is. This is the science program.
Oh,
dope this, dope that. All right, after hours, keep this underground. But
after hours, I was damn. And I just felt so welcome. And they were, of course, doing all this shit that we should not have been doing as high school seniors. But they told us when we got there, you will make some of the best friends in your life this weekend. And true enough, I did. I met some of my best homies that are now my best homies here in LA, and we met at that new admit weekend. And a lot of those kids were getting offers from out of state schools, from Ivy League, from blah, 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 from UCLA, blah, blah, blah.
It's that minority, you're so great, we want you to,
but
be in our school.
Once we were around together, we really formed a bit of a fraternity, you know what I mean? We were okay, I'll see you in the fall. And sure enough, like, we all decided to go there because we had that person-to-person contact.
And then you kept in touch or snail mail.
Yeah, you no, it was like the first year that they were handing out email addresses.
Oh, no shit. Yeah. Dang.
It was like the
so
beginning.
It's like, hold on, get off the phone.
It was like the beginning of email. So, it was an amazing experience. Very difficult. Again, I started writing for the Daily Cal because I just thought, we don't have no one covering this and this and this and this. I was the only Chicano kid there, and all the other raza, a lot of them were like, yeah, that's a sellout publication, don't write for them, write for La Voz de UC Berkeley or whatever. Está bien. Like, you know, but we need someone in there to advocate for us and to do shit. And it's
that representation.
A little bit. It does, it really does help. But one of the first things I did was write about a deep division in Mecha.
Oh.
At Berkeley.
Exclusive.
And I was like a freshman, and there was a huge seismic divide between Mecha de UC Berkeley and then an offshoot that called itself Berkeley Mecha.
Was this already there when you got there? Or
it was.
Like...
It started. It had been percolating, and then it broke, and it happened.
Oh.
And then there was a massive meeting and position papers. Y no sé qué. Y que Berkeley Mecha was going to reclaim the original. The statement or the Plan de Atlan or whatever statement.
Yeah, from like the 60s.
Going back to the foundational principles, y que no sé qué. And I wrote basically an article saying like a deep division within one of the oldest, I think it might be the oldest Mecha chapter in the country, besides whatever ones were founded in Denver or whatever, that like, I thought this is a historically important student organization. It's extremely relevant to all of us and to me in particular, to understand that there are divisions within it that should be healed. And so I wrote about it, and of course the offshoot group named me like persona non grata, pero así como
over here.
I think they were training all new incoming freshmen until I left the campus to never speak to me.
Wow, don't talk to Daniel Hernandez.
So there was like an automatic schism, and I'm just like, yeah, like at the end of the day, when you shine light on uncomfortable truths and uncomfortable scenarios, especially when they have to do with your direct community, you are providing a community service whether people see it that way or not.
They'll get over it
because you are offering a window and an opportunity to examine whatever issues and conflicts a community is having, either internally or externally, in a way that will eventually, that just documents. Journalism is the first draft of history, and we need to be writing our first drafts. And not permit sort of others to do it really without our input or without our gaze. And so that's why I've always stuck with mainstream outlets. And left or progressive outlets are very important. They're part of my diet.
Everybody has their place in the system. Yeah.
I agree. You know, it's like it's important for me to read The Nation, and it's important for me to read Knock LA, and it's important for me to read everything, you know?
Es el clasificado.
Exacto. It's el aviso. Like, that's where I know where a lot is going on with, like, the paisa community. Like, it's como muy importante to read the local papers and just know what's happening in your area, you know?
All right. Well, with that, it's time for you to take a break and go feed the machine.
Oh my God, it is.
We can pause right now. Daniel put some more money in his meter. I messed around with the little speaker. Can you?
Okay.
Oh yeah.
How's this? Boom,
we're
boom.
Good. We're good. Folks don't really need to hear me. You can hear me, but I'm not the focus here. So, you're at Berkeley. You're like throwing, you know, down, getting into the mix. When did you graduate from?
I graduated in 2002. I was an English major. I did my concentration in bilingual children's literature. I tried to do ethnic studies. So I think initially I had been declared an ethnic studies major.
All right.
And it was a great department, obviously, at Berkeley, but I kind of felt that I wanted to just, like, read other shit, you know, mm-hmm. and not be depressed all the time and, like,
just
not...
get that whip.
And, you know, so I switched, and it was pretty cool, it was great, you know, but I really worked all the time at the Daily Cal. I became editor of the Daily Cal, I became the first Latino editor of the Daily Cal.
Nice.
I think since like the 70s or something, there had been someone.
That's a long time.
A long ass time. The Daily Cal was actually a conservative paper at the time, and it had editorialized in favor of Prop 209. And my ass went in there anyway, because I was like, fuck these guys. And I eventually garnered, this was an elected position, within the ranks of the staff.
Yeah.
And I think I eventually just earned enough of the respect of the other students there to be entrusted with that role. And it was a very important role because it was a completely independent paper that had no financial affiliation with the university.
Oh, wow. I didn't even, like, put it out.
So we got ad money from selling ads and had actually adult staffers that we paid to sell ads for us. We were incorporated. The Daily Cal split from the university in 1971 over People's Park. And over the fight over People's Park. It was one of the first truly independent campus papers. That's why they could say whatever they want editorially. But I just felt that I wanted training, and I knew I wanted this kind of, I guess, as my career. It just felt like something that I was always capable of doing. So it's like kind of like, if I can do it, why not? You know? And so, but I was kind of on a track, because Berkeley is like, it's a tough place. You can often feel very isolated. No one is holding your hand. Even when I had, like, my little, like, Raza network, it was still tough. Like,
it's trial by fire, yeah.
You know, kids drop out. There are suicides. Like, it's ugly. Like, it can be very alienating and a lonely experience. And so I was felt like I was hitting all the right buttons and doing the right things. And I was a scholarship student, so I was always getting invited to university functions so I could be their little brown face. And you put on your Berkeley tie and, like... Like the movies, you know, like it has this sort of like vibe that it sort of projects itself to be this university. And I felt very underprepared. You know, I still went to a public school, and even the Chicano students that I was around were all like Loyola or like some like rich ass, you know, like wealthy, even if they were scholarship students, they went to fancy private schools. And I was a public school kid. Even if I went to the best public school, if you want, in my district, it was still a struggle to be ready for the academic rigor. And I see that a lot today still, you know, that there's this disconnect from what they offer you in high school to the demands that you have once you get to the university.
Yeah.
But I was in and out. I wanted to get the hell out of there. I wanted to get in the world. And I kept meeting gringos, Californians, very, like, entitled. Like, going to Berkeley was sort of, like, burned into their DNA since they were little.
Like, predestined for me.
Like, and many of them had actually been legacy students, meaning their grandfather or great-grandparents went to Berkeley. So it was tough, honestly, but it was also a great learning experience, and I had a great time. I got to know Oakland, obviously, San Francisco. A brother of mine had just gotten out of the service, and so he moved to San Francisco to go to school, and then eventually he, like, slept on my couch for 6 months in Berkeley. Like, it was just, I had a very Rascuacha experience, even though I had a somewhat public experience. I was already thinking, like, okay, let me finish my degree. And let me get the hell out of here, because I wanted to get out in the world. And I felt, again, a little stifled by academia and by some of the sort of assumptions that guide the culture in academia.
Here, let me change the time. Okay.
Let's see, how's that?
I changed better? It back to the original setting, I think, because now
you
can hear.
Does it sound better?
You sound great, but it wasn't picking me up
okay,
as much. I'm still figuring this out, folks.
Boom, boom.
I think that's how a lot of folks feel. You know, you're in school, especially out of state. You know, you're out of your element and you just want to get out of there and, like, go figure things out on your own.
Yeah.
So, like, you graduated. Did you stay up there or did you move back home?
Well, a lot of people like to stay up there, and a lot of my friends stayed up there. But I wanted to actually go to the East Coast.
All right.
This time I was like, I'm going to go, la, la, la. And then something happened. The LA Times called up. And actually, they had a recruiter at the journalism school. Berkeley has a graduate school of journalism only for graduate students. I was taking a coursework there as a senior. I was taking some courses there as a senior. And they had to write me in and let my ass in. And it was a magazine course. And then there was a recruiter there. And then randomly, the office lady was like, the LA Times' recruiter is here. You should just go in there. So I, you know, printed my resume, ran up to the J school, met the guy, Randy Hagihara, one face I'll never forget. He's recently left LA Times. Third generation Japanese Angelino, just had that voice. He had it in his accent, you know what I'm saying? Smoker.
Yeah.
Sitting there with a grim face, never cracked a smile. I told him who I was, what I wanted to do, what I was capable of. And at the end of it, he's like, you're the best person I've seen all day, and I've been dealt with only grad students all day. And I was like, boom, let's do it. So then... They offered me an internship in Los Angeles, and then, you know, I'm 20 years old, and I move down to have my first real experience in LA by myself. Most of my extended family either stayed in the border or went to Northern Cali. Mm. So my uncles moved to San Jose and to Tracy, California. Every summer we crossed the Central Valley to go to Tracy, blah, blah, blah. I didn't know LA. None of our families are really in LA. We have extended, long lost family.
Cousin here.
Some cousin that I've lost touch with that I actually want to find because I know that they settled in Boyle Heights, but that was in the 20s.
Oh, wow.
Through my grandma's, paternal grandma's side. So I do have some long-term extended relatives somewhere here in Boyle Heights. I would like to find them one day, maybe.
Yeah, somebody knows them.
But I'd never really spent time in L.A., you know, and suddenly I was working in downtown L.A. The first place I lived was at a summer sublet in Westwood. My ass was commuting every day from Westwood Village on the 10 to downtown L.A. And it was crazy, but I fell in love with it almost right away, you know. I had been told, like everyone else, warned about L.A., never move there, never go there, avoid it, you know, because it's like the earth, it's like everyone in California hates L.A. except the people in L.A. You know?
A lot of people around the country hate L.A.
And it's like, L.A. I quickly realize is indifferent to what anyone thinks about it from the outside.
It's like, whatever.
Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, you know, it's, there is no need. And then gradually, I think it started to open it up for me, Los Angeles, because I started hanging out with my homie from Cal. You know, my homie Valmiki, he's from Eagle Rock. And, you know, he went to Loyola. He's just like, you know, he also moved back home to Eagle Rock. I got hired by the LA Times out of school in 2002. And I didn't know anyone in LA. I read Proust. You know, I read Remembrance of Things Past. And then I started hanging out with Val. And Val started taking me to shows. He started taking me to self-help. He started taking me to, like, weird underground galleries and weird underground hip-hop shows. And then...
Yeah, that's the heyday, you know, of all that.
It was the heyday. I got to see fucking... God, everyone, like... Everyone, you know, Ozu Motley, like, playing at self-help back when they were just playing at self-help, you know, just for the fuck of it. You know what I'm saying? Like, those days, and I got to see that, and it started opening up for me, and the food, it started opening up to me in terms of the food options that I had here that hadn't had anywhere else.
I started getting into that scene toward the tail end of it, and I was like, wow, like, the old self-help, have Gage... Yeah. The trifecta of bands playing, like Quinto Sol, Ozu Motley, Quetzal, Aztlan Underground. Yeah. So, to me, that was like the kind of like you, like you really got connected and you start figuring out where, like, yeah, this is where, you know, things are at. This is where you get the bomb tacos. This is where you go get the great shows.
Yeah.
I remember when the art walk in downtown LA was first starting nobody knew what was going on, but I was like, you know, a little bit in the know to know that this was happening and I can just go everywhere and like get, you know, like White Girl Wasted on Wine from the different galleries.
Exactly. So it really opened up and I fell in love with it and I thought, you know what? I'm just going to hit the ground running. And I'm going to cover Los Angeles the way I cover the city that I see before me. So I wrote just about everything, about the street, about graffiti, about murals, about... I wrote about Florentine Gardens, and I couched it for the first time as a social space for young Latinos who could get into a old club, being 18 and up. And I wrote how this was essentially a rite of passage for so many people in Southern California, was going to Florentine Gardens in Hollywood and listening to, like, house and to, you know, freestyle.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, that's one thing I was doing when I was looking up info for the interview and prepping, is that a lot of what kind of, like, your early writings, basically from, like, 2006 till now, is on your personal blog, the Intersections blog. Like, that, to me, I realized, because I used to follow it back in the day, and then... I can tell, like, you know, nobody really has a blog anymore. Like, yeah. I have a podcast. That's the new blog.
Yep.
It's, you know, you became a little bit more sporadic with it. But in the heyday, you know, you were so consistent with it that you were always, for folks that never been on it, you know, he would talk about what he was working on at the time, stories that he published, and, like, letting you know, I wrote about this. Here's the link. You should go, like, check it out. So if folks are, really want to deep dive into it, go to his... Intersections blog. It's what, intersections.typepad.com typepad.com?
Thank you, Eric. Yeah, it's danielhernandez.typepad.com.
That's the one.
I really need to get that URL a little updated.
Just did mine like this year, after 10 years
blogspot.something.
Yeah.
But I kind of like the old schoolness of the .typepad URL a little bit. It just kind of stuck around, but yeah.
Why would you want to pay like $12 a year?
I know, but the heyday of blogging was pretty sick. We were really busting open the model about writing and how to write about ourselves, you know? And so I had to write about what I was writing for work, which was LA Times or LA Weekly, but I would add more material, throw other things in, and just describe and just start doing my own map and my own geography of the city, and really feeling that all of it was open to me and all of it was available to access with the right approach and with the right kind of respect and attempted understanding. And so it was kind of before the sort of the avalanche of gentrification, also in a way, in terms of the violent form that it has taken place today. The early signs were all there.
The train was coming. Yeah,
but we didn't really understand or see it.
No, yeah. Like Highland Park, Echo Park was like still in transition.
Highland Park was like completely off the map as far as many people were concerned.
Yeah. Know?
And I remember going to the peak show parties in Highland Park, and there was like tea parties, and like a lot of cool shit was going on. And it felt like a trek to go to Highland Park from Echo Park. That's how like small we were.
Yeah. Would you remember like some of your favorite stories from like these early days from like the LA Weekly, the LA Times?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, for the LA Times, I did one of the first stories that they ever did on Day of the Dead. This was in 2001, and it was I think the second time that they did a Hollywood Forever, Hollywood Forever.
Yeah, in the early stages. They've only been around 15, 16 years.
Yeah, so I did one of the first stories about that festival, and I remember bringing it to my editors and having no clue, literally no clue what it was.
Wow.
And now Day of the Dead is like a national gringo holiday.
There's movies about it, there's party supplies at the party store. I mean, low key, I'm over here buying like coffee mugs and like t-shirts and socks.
I know. But,
right behind us, there's a piñata too.
It was not like that, you know? I did one of the first front page articles about graffiti, and sort of in a way, subversively, I think I was trying to legitimize graffiti for our readers.
Was it, I think you wrote something on Chaka, I don't know if it was that one, I think you were like just mentioning it.
I didn't do Chaka, I did do a bunch of murals at the end it was like local improvement or associations want to whitewash murals in order to up their values.
Oh.
And so then there was like a bunch of these murals here in Boyle Heights. In East LA and in downtown that I was basically mapping and saying, like, for example, I wrote a front page article about the Belmont Tunnel. Does anyone remember that?
I remember Belmont Tunnel. I went to Belmont for a year. That was my favorite place to live in Pico Union.
Yeah, so.
And now if there's housing, there's like condo living apartments, and they're like the Belmont Station apartments or something.
None of that shit was there before. Before it was a big gaping hole that was a tunnel through downtown. And it was literally the best graffiti gallery on the West Coast. Everyone came to write there. Everyone from New York who had, you know...
It's like 5 points in New York.
It was like 5 points. Everyone went there to paint there. There must have been feet layers of thick of spray paint. Over the years there. And I mapped that place for Los Angeles and for the greater audience, I think. And for the readers of the LA Times are mostly old white people in the Valley. Like... You have to kind of show them what this is about. And so I would always fight with that with my own editors. They'd be like, well, a general reader doesn't know that. And I would fight with my editors and be like, what is a general reader? Because I think I'm a pretty general reader.
Yeah. Describe them to me.
You know? So I was always, even as a kid, I was aware that the what is described as mainstream is so insidious because we are the mainstream. Mm-hmm. And so you're actually just the outlier that's just holding on to legacy power and to legacy impression of what is mainstream, but we are actually the mainstream. So in every one of my stories at the LA Times, I pushed to do that, but it was still such a stodgy conservative place at the end of the day that I was like, oh, I'm young and I'm wild and I'm a punk and I hate everything. So then that's why I quit the LA Times and I went to the LA Weekly.
Yeah, back when it was good.
Back when it was good, and it was so good, man. My editor was Laurie Ochoa. She said, do whatever you want. It was fucking great.
Damn. Yeah. Oh, man. So, you know, you had your runs at the LA Times, at the LA Weekly, and then let's kind of fast forward to when you decided, fuck LA, I'm going to Mexico.
Yeah, well, you know, I had the enormous... this goes back to Berkeley, actually. I would meet gringos and be like, yeah, I've been to Teotihuacan, I've been to Palenque, you know, Chichen Itza. My parents first took me to Mexico City when I was 5, and I'm just like, how do these kids know more about Mexico and seen more of Mexico than me? And I have the enormous privilege of having been born here and being able to take my ass back there whenever I want and come back home here. So I just thought, you know, all my other Chicano friends were talking about going to New York or to Paris or to London, which are the cool cities in the early 2000s that you wanted to go to. And I was like, I'm going to Mexico City, you know, and everyone's like, what? Why? Like, it's so ugly.
What?
Feos, chilangos, they're going to rob you, they're going to kidnap you.
I don't think that ever that stereotype is ever going to die.
It's never going to die.
As I tell people, oh, I'm from El Defe, and I was like, no, I was born there.
I was born there.
I was there till I was 7, but...
Damn, that's late.
You know, I mean, like, I grew up here in the States, here in Mojave, so it's like, I can't... I'm not out here like chale.
Si, chale.
I still have an uncle who speaks like that.
That's great. And I actually discovered that there's multiple DF accents. Like, yeah, when you get down there, you hear different ones that are tied to class or to actual space.
You know, that's one of the things I like doing is watching all those old sexy comedias with like the comedians that are like fucking pervs.
Yeah.
But like mostly with like Juan Camané because of like his accent and his mannerisms and like the way he's just saying shit.
So paisita.
Yeah, because that was like, I remember when my dad, like, he used to like fucking mimic him like to the T, or like, you know, he was a borracho.
Sí.
He was out there doing his thing and stuff like that, and like, I, you know, like his little spiel, bailo tango, da da da.
You heard it.
Yeah, so it's like, that's like ingrained in my memory, is like, that's a part of Mexico that'll never exist anymore.
Right.
Depending, like, maybe it might be in some pockets, but it's like, to the general public, I don't think it'll be there.
Dude, I think that's a super good question for anyone who does, you know, linguistics or sociology. Like, the LA accent, I think, has changed as well. Mm-hmm. Like, if you listen to really old footage of Mexican Americans, LA people, on the radio or on TV in the 80s, there was such a thick East Side,
like,
como accent, man. You know, that I think has also. Exactly.
I trip out on this too, because when I went to New York, like, it's in my mindset, it's the same. It's that New York accent. It's like, hey, mm-hmm. you know, I'm walking here.
Yeah, and that one also, I feel like, is kind of dying.
It's fading away, yeah.
You know? So when we have television shows and things like that to sort of try to reflect the realities now or from before, I feel like that's, you know, it's blues is, I don't know how to describe that, you know what I'm saying? Like, what happens to that way of talking?
I mean, part of it is just everybody's moving around. Everything's shifting. Yeah. Generations, you know, are making their own thing, which is like one of the things I wanted to bring up a little later was when you wrote that piece about like folks now using the Latinx. Instead of, like, the traditional Latina, Latino, and, like, everybody going after you you wrote that.
The Latinx, the Latinx.
So, you're hearing all these stories from everybody else of, like, fuck Mexico, or, like, I was there and you never been there.
Yeah, and I was like, I gotta go see it for myself. And I gotta see, and I fell in love with it. I just, you know, I was always just like, I just loved the challenge of it. And I love the food, and I love the culture, and I love the people, and I love just the pace and the rhythm.
Yeah, like you were talking about earlier, being on the train.
Yeah.
Sometimes you're just getting shoved in there.
Yeah, you're getting shoved in. It's like you don't know the vendedor that you're going to see.
Pásale, pásale, DVD, DVD.
DVD, DVD, DVD. At the Puerto Tianguis. DVD.
Oh, man.
Hijos madrecinos. An incredible experience. But it's also weirdly not Mexican in the sense that when you go to the FA, like, you are going to meet Swedes and French people and Germans and Haitians and Nigerians and Brazilians and like, it is so sophisticated, to use a simple word, and so advanced in a weird way in terms of its relationship to the rest of the world. There's obviously all the major embassies are there, but I think also a lot of intelligence agencies are locused there.
Really?
Yeah, oh my, of course. I mean, the Russian embassy is massive. The Chinese embassy is massive.
Wow.
I mean, Mexico has always been kind of the playground of the world in a way. I'm not simply thinking of like Cancun and Spring Breakers, but like everyone gets to move there and do whatever the hell they want, and it's usually easier for you to do so if
because
you're,
like, you can just like pay off the government connections,
yeah,
things like
connections, and also, you know, like Mexico is kind of neutral in the Cold War in a certain way, and the fact that it was, you know, yes, aligned with the United States because of proximity, but there was obviously a deep, always relationship. There's a relation, a strong relationship today to China in Mexico, you know, so it's like, you know, it's just a different place. It's just not the United States, and it's not Europe. And so you have this kind of weird landscape of both that, like, keeps you really on your toes, and you meet people from all over the world. And I really felt for the first time when I lived there that I was part of the world, and that I liked that feeling because it was the end of the Bush years, and I thought Bush was the worst that America could get. I imagine the naivety of that. I really thought George W. Bush was the worst that we could have in this country.
Proved us all wrong.
And look at us now.
Damn. Yeah. So when you moved to Mexico, this is one thing I really wanted to talk about, because I was doing my homework preparing for this. I watched the multi-part series you did for, like, Munchies when you were in Oaxaca. If you haven't seen, it's legit. You should check it out.
It's fun.
Focuses on different, like, foods and regions. But here's Daniel, like, out here, like, eating, hanging out. Like, the first one where, like, the opening is, like, those kids are taking a picture with you.
Yeah.
And you're just walking around in your Raiders jacket.
Yeah. And that's a bootleg Raiders jacket. Great Raiders jacket. From Mexico City, actually.
Dang. So you're just out there, like, eating tacos, you know, drinking. I remember, like, the mushroom episode or, like, one other episode. I mean, you can just tell you're faded.
Yeah.
You know, you're so happy. You're like, I'm about to get, like, some consomme, some tacos, go to this bar and hang out.
We were so faded, man. I didn't even know the cameras were there most of the time. I was just having
that's a good thing, because then you're
time
just
of
like,
my life.
You're
yeah.
just doing like you're just having a blast,
yeah.
and that really comes across. This is why that's one of my guilty pleasures is watching like the Mexico episodes of Munchies from Vice. The other show that's one of my favorites is Todos los Tacos, that dude is hilarious.
I love
him,
dude.
He's like, let me take a bite of this trompo de pastor.
it was fun.
How did you end up working for Vice?
Well, I kept doing intersections in Mexico, and that was really key for people to find me and different editors to find me, actually.
All right.
You know, the thing was kind of dying down, the whole blog thing. I was working on my book down in Delirious in Mexico City. That's
right
why
here.
I see it. So thank you. It's lovely to see it. I moved down there on a book contract. But I kept freelancing. I burned through my advance. I did a lot of drugs and did a lot of drinking. And then I had to start working. So I started freelancing again. And then, lo and behold, guess what? The fucking drug war starts. And all of a sudden, Mexico is drowning in violence and we had no idea how to handle that. You know what I'm saying? Like, Mexico as a whole, sort of like, it was just like, what's going on? It's getting worse and worse and worse by the day in terms of the violence and the sense of insecurity and the really war crimes. I would call them war crimes, the real atrocities that occurred on the hands of the Mexican military and at the hands of...
It's just happening all around.
Warring drug cartels and just hitting every state. And kind of like cockroaches, because it's like you put out the violence here, supposedly, according to the government, and then it pops up somewhere else, and it's just like... There was no relief, you know what I'm saying? And so I had to start being a drug war reporter, basically, and I never thought I would. I was an arts and culture guy, technically.
Yeah.
You know, and next thing you know, I'm covering the drug war, and then I got hired by the LA Times. I was there 3 years, and then I got hired by Vice.
Correspondent
down there and stopped working on stuff. And then I got hired by Vice, and I was first editor of Vice Mexico, and that's when I did Munchies.
Mm-hmm.
They're just like, you're American, and you speak English, and you also understand this culture. We're putting you in front of the camera. Here, go. And
wow,
like,
just like that.
Just like that.
Dang.
Know? And I was like, okay, like, let's do it.
There's a lot of great stuff. If you ever get a chance, just guilty pleasure it. You know, don't think twice about what Vice is sometimes.
Yeah. No, my shit was fun, dude. Like, because I knew I was talking to you guys.
Yeah.
You know, I knew.
And I think you still get that. You're like, hey, you're that guy from Vice.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Here in L.A., it's like when I started visiting and after all those videos. it was really cool to see how people knew the work and it, something in it touched them and they responded and people responded.
To me, that's what it is. Like, you know, having not being able to go back since I left and seeing it through, like, the spectrum of, like, you and, like, the other folks.
Here.
Yeah. Like, one of my favorite episodes when, like, where they were at Tepito and they were covering the soccer game with the...
with the trans.
Trans folks. So I was like, man, like, I see, like, all the ambiance and, like, the tianguis. Because, I mean, my parents used to work at one, so I kind of
really?
Grew up there.
Which one?
I have no idea. All they tell me was that I was an asshole.
Damn.
Because my padrinos were that had a stand to selling clothing, and they my parents would sell fruit. So, you know, I was there hanging out, and I was like a little kid, so I was running around everywhere. Everybody knew me, and I would go to my padrino's post and just lock their shit up.
Dang! Que travieso!
Basically. So, I mean, to me, it's like, damn, man, I really like two things. I really want to go back and, like, you know, experience this all for myself the same way, you know, kind of you did, were like, well, fuck everybody telling me about it. I want to go see it for myself.
Yeah.
And then the other thing, too, is, like, and some folks know this already, is I want my own show like that.
Yeah.
Like, you just, like, you hey, should. Like, Vice, give me my own show.
Yeah.
You know, I'll take you to all the spots in Ball Heights and whatnot. Like, they gave one to Eddie Huang, you know, they got, like, he's out here in Ball Heights eating at DeSalo's. I was like,
yeah, whatever, dude. Like, you totally should, man. The Eric Huerta hour.
Oh, I mean, this is one step closer to it with this podcast. But another story that you know, it's not as, like, impactful as some of the stuff you've done, like the violence and, like, the killings and stuff like that. But one that, like, sticks out in my mind is, like, you were one of the folks covering the emo wars when it was happening.
The emo wars, that was big. Oh my god, yes. And I think that's when me and you first started engaging online and
stuff. I mean we've been in contact through, like, the spaces before, but that's when, like,
okay,
it came around again. And I mean, let folks know what happened with Los Emos in Mexico.
Well, it was
this was 2008.
Really crazy. Do you remember that 10 years ago now?
Yep.
When that kind of haircut was really in with the kids.
So it's the emo traditional haircut when it's like you have it, like, slick, that it's like covering half your face and your eye. You know, it's like the spikiness going on
the
side.
Bat. Come on, peacock.
Yeah, and then you got like multiple colors going in there. It's the very traditional emo look.
And it boomed in Mexico in 2007, 2008. And all of a sudden, every 15 to 18 year old was looking like an emo, wearing super skinny jeans,
yeah,
listening to, like, My Chemical Romance.
It's like the
and,
Hot Topic, like, prototypical outfit.
Hot Topic. It was like every city in Mexico was like that. And one day, just some hooligans just came out and just started beating the shit out of every emo they saw in downtown Querétaro. Because what the kids would do is they would end up gathering in public spaces and plazas and just kind of colonizing the plaza for a little bit, taking the space, you know, hanging out, checking each other out, doing their hair. A lot of the boys were wearing eye makeup, you know, smudged under their eyes, and it sort of got on that boundary between sort of like being accused of being like accused, right? But being like called gay. They were calling them pinches maricones, pinches emos, and so they just went out and started beating the shit out of a bunch of kids. When that happened, there was an article in La Jornada the next day, and it was very confusing and very weirdly written. Next thing you know, these attacks start happening everywhere in Mexico City, so I started covering it, and it was a trip. You know, it's a chapter in the book, and it was just this blip of culture in this moment and this confrontation over what happens to the subcultural landscape when a new subculture emerges, or like new in quotes, you know, but when sort of something changes with the young people and how the slightly older generations respond to that.
And this is a culture from another place. This is something that wasn't like homegrown or was already like there.
Yeah.
Right?
No, but what I learned in Mexico is that the kids there are very sophisticated when it comes to music and rock and la la la.
It's like your tribe. You're like metalero, rockero.
If you're
rockero,
a metalero, you know every fucking important European band. You know every important album.
Like Judas Priest, Iron Maiden, Motorhead.
It's not a costume for kids.
Nope.
Down there. There is a really smart way that they are consuming these, what are essentially foreign movements and cultures, and interesting, because that's how the FA has always been, you know. So it was really interesting. The emos faded away, obviously. Many of them migrated to other cultures and other
tribes. It's like, I'm tired of getting my ass beat.
Yeah, it's like some of them just became like, you know, hardcore
Yeah, Pug, you know, like almost like the next like thing close to that.
Yeah, or they went full goth, you know.
Full goth. Man, yeah. I had a crush on a goth girl in high school.
Goth is, I learned, because that part of my practice when I was in Mexico was kind of researching the different subcultures, I found different things that I did sort of identify with in many ways. And so I felt very at home around the goth kids, and I felt very at home around the skinhead kids, not the racist ones, but, you know, regular skinheads.
Like the punk ones.
Punk skinheads.
Oh, man, that was a trip. But
so it was a trip.
All right, so the time's almost up here. I can already see the next person in the show coming up.
Oh, my gosh.
they passed by. We still got a couple of minutes, but let's kind of fast forward.
Let's talk about here. What's going on
here?
Yeah,
you wrote your book. You moved back to L.A. What do you got going on right now? You kind of already mentioned this already.
Okay, yeah. So I covered Ayotzinapa. I covered the Chapo thing. I launched Vice News in Latin America. Then I think I just burned out, man. I missed.
That was intense.
I just burned out, honestly. I thought I was going to buy a house in Mexico. I thought going to get married in Mexico. I thought I was going to live my life there. But when I saw my parents getting older and getting crying when they would take me to the airport for a routine flight back to Mexico City, I thought, okay, so A, I'm stressing the fuck out of my parents.
Given everything that's going on.
B, like, Vice, I'm doing 3 jobs at once at Vice, and I'm burning out on the demands. And C, I began to realize that I really was ultimately a California kid in my heart, and that I really was missing the sea air and the salt air on a daily basis. Mexico City is higher than Denver. You know, it has 2 volcanoes around it. It's earthquake prone. The air is thin. The smog is some of the worst in the world historically. It just kind of got to me. And in the summer, it rains, you know. So I started seeing through, like, my feeds on Facebook and shit, like, the wonderful beachside photos of my friends or, like, people just enjoying the sunlight. And I'm like,
mofo.
I need that. Like, that's who I am. Like, I felt I became more Californian in Mexico. So while I spent a good chunk of years while I was doing Down in Delirious, listening to a lot of rock en español, listening to a lot of Mexican rock, a lot of Mexican goth and, like, hardcore bands like Hocico and stuff like that, like, and punk bands and, like, the old classic rock shit like El Tri and all that, like, I really me empapé en eso, and I really got into it. And then as I started missing California, I was like, a 90s hip hop, like, I just, like, became more hip hop, and I sort of naturally really realized that I was ultimately a Californian, and understanding what that kind of identity means. And I felt that that transformation happened because I was in Mexico. You know what I'm saying? Like, that people, even though I spent 6-7 years there, people could still tell that I was from up here.
It's like, you're not from here.
They just, something they can smell on me or see in the way I work.
That Raiders jacket.
I don't know why. I know, right? Something. It really just, like, I was a norteño to people, and I always was. And so,
yeah, it's funny because one of the episodes, you're commenting to the camera in English, and, like, one of the chefs is like, I don't know what you said, but that sounds, like, great.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, because sometimes my pochismos would come out, and I couldn't help it. And so, to a lot of people down there, it was they welcomed me in a way that I don't think they would have if I'd just been from there, you know. I was the anomaly. I was the weird Mexican gringo. And plus, I had come from L.A., right when L.A. was at its peak of being cool, quote-unquote. Not being cool in the mainstream of the way it is today.
Yeah.
But sort of, it was sort of like this weird, it was like the New York of the, you know, it's like, they just thought that you were fucking cool as fuck for being from L.A., basically, you know. And sort of, I was able to use that to get into certain kind of social spaces that I don't think I would have entered otherwise. But, it was time for me to come back. And so I burned out, you know, it got heavy, you know. And so I come back here, and everything to me here, pardon me, but everything here is first world problems, man. Like, it is so first world problems here. Like, I can't even say it. Like, and so that kind of perspective, I think, is very important for us to understand one another and to keep in mind that I spent 8 years wondering on a daily basis if the water would turn on when I got home and opened it.
Damn.
You know, everyone lives through that there. Those little things that really make you appreciate that living in the first world, or, you know, to use the the colonial terms or whatever, or the developed world, comes with a lot of privilege.
Mm-hmm.
And that oftentimes the conflicts or the issues that we think here are like very do or die are actually not do or die, but they do have, and they do manifest in other forms of violence and other forms of displacement and other forms of oppression, but very infrequently to the levels that people deal with in Mexico. And in particular, if you're indigenous Mexican or mixed dark Mexican, whatever,
yeah,
or poor, because one of the advantages that we have here is social mobility.
Is that classism, racism?
The classism down there is what really guides and defines your life. And it's very difficult for people to emerge out of that. And that's a problem with Mexico fundamentally that is a holdover from the colony. So Mexico is still trying to figure it out. Here in the United States, we're still trying to figure out, but in different ways, you know.
Damn, those fucking fresas out there, man.
Yeah, fresas aquí también los tenemos.
So you're back in LA. Your parents are glad that you're back, you know, closer to home. How did you end up working for LA Taco? What was that like?
Okay, so I asked Vice to move me back here. They did, and then they're like, don't really care. And then I asked to move to the LA office to be closer to home and not the Brooklyn office.
Like in Venice, no?
It's in Venice, yeah. So, you know, and it was just, they were not, how can I put this? They were not interested in LA stories, and they were just not letting me cover the stories that I wanted to do.
Mm.
And so gradually, there was just a separation there. It's like, I would raise my hand all the time, use me for this, let's do a food show here, a lot, but Vice at the end of the day ends up being one of these companies that gets too big for its own good and kind of loses some of its heart and its spirit and its soul. And there are a lot of collateral, let's say, that gets lost along the way. And so after about a year of sitting there twiddling my thumbs, not doing nothing, letting the election go by before my eyes, this is the most Mexican election in history. And there were no Mexicans at a national level on the panels, on MSNBC, on CNN, on Vice. Like, it's like this was that 2016 was the year to call us up and really put us front and center in this debate. There was no DACA person every night on CNN telling us what the, you know what I'm saying? Like, where are we? And I think at the end of the day, it was still just basically a white organization that just couldn't handle. People are afraid of educated Mexican Americans.
I bet.
And it really throws people off when they're just used to seeing you as the taquero or the quiet guy on the bus.
Yeah, soundbite.
Or the guy in the kitchen.
Yeah.
Or a brown person for a soundbite. But when you start raising actual questions and giving actual feedback and proving people that you're just as qualified and just as skilled and just as knowledgeable as the next guy, if not more, well, then you are a threat. And I really felt that for the first time when I moved back here, because I don't like being treated like I'm less than anyone, like anyone else. But I'm very attuned to when professionally I am, and that's when I'm just like, all right, fuck you then, you know?
Yeah.
So I did the best that I could. I put myself in, and then, you know, I left Vice, and then I worked for some other company that did nothing happen. And then finally, the publisher of LA Taco was like, I'm looking for an editor. I'm looking for someone to really take...
Was it Alex?
Alex, the editor. Alex Blaisdell, the editor of LA Taco, called me up and was like, now, we got to do this now.
Yeah, because LA is shut down. Just left.
You know, it was right after LA is shut down. It was right after all the people at the Weekly were fired.
That's right.
So he just said, the time is now. We have to do something. We have to do something for the community. And it's so obviously a need to cover LA from the brown perspective, from the streets, and from the taco lifestyle kind of perspective.
Yeah, because I don't really see that many people of color at KPCC.
No, are you there now?
No. But I mean, at this point, because I drive, it's my default like radio station just to know what's going on.
Yeah, it's a little. This is what I've told editors in LA all along. This is a brown ass city, and you need to cover it that way and that as your baseline. All your other readers also want to hear it because it is their city as well, in the sense that they are interacting with us,
mm-hmm,
you know, every day. And so I'm so happy at LA Taco. That's what we're able to do every day. We're just, you know, and we're still small. We're still only publishing twice a day, you know. It's like, but it's something. It's a drop in the bucket, and I think LA really needed it, and I think LA so far is very appreciative of the kind of tempo and temperature that we're introducing, and we just want to keep growing. We want to be more on the radio. We want to go on to get on TV, and hopefully we'll get there.
Little by little. I mean, LA Taco's been around for a long time. The first time I wrote something for them was in 2007. I continued on through there, like, sporadically. One of the other biggest things that I did there was I, like you said, like, Day of the Dead has become this big-ass thing in LA that I eventually, like, created these just blog posts where I'm giving you a lineup of all the Day of the Dead stuff that's happening in Los Angeles because it's just so overwhelming.
Oh, you should do that again for us.
I was like, I should start now if I'm going to do it.
Yeah.
Because things are just, like, people are already making the Facebook events and, like, putting the calendar invites out there. And then you have, like, the go-to shows, like the Hollywood Forevers, the Grand Parks,
mm-hmm.
you know, the self-help graphics. And then, like, little community spaces doing their own thing. But now, like, so you came on board, you know, you're, like, guiding the direction. And now you're bringing in other folks, too. So you brought in Javier, who, shout out, he's been on the show before. And you just brought on Gustavo Arellano.
Gustavo Arellano is, like, an editor-at-large. I mean, he's going to be just pitching in when he can. Javier, super busy doing stuff. We have a new guy named Eric Galindo, who you should meet. Super cool kid. He's from Southeast.
Is he the one that wrote the piece about going to the wrestling school?
No, that was Frank Tristan.
That's Frank.
He's also really good. He lives in Orange County. He writes for the OC Weekly, and he can only write about LA stuff for us. He can't write OC stuff because it's for the OC Weekly.
Territories.
You know, territories. But they're great, man. We want to encourage young writers, new writers, bring people up.
Give them the pitch. Give them the pitch.
You know, and I publish first-time writers, and I publish writers with incredible amounts of history and experience. So if you have a story that you think we should go on LA Taco, well, let's see it. You know, what is that?
Oh, it's a camera.
Oh, hey.
It's a 360 camera.
Sick.
But, yeah, LA Taco is one of those underrated spaces because, you know, there was a saturation of media, LA Weekly, LA Is, Curbed LA, LA Times. But, like Daniel was talking about earlier, there's always a need for folks to be able to have a platform of their own to tell their stories, to tell a different side of what's going on. You know, and that's one of the things I've always loved about LA Taco. You always get that random side thing that you normally wouldn't get in a traditional space, like the KPCs, the LA Times, and what have you.
I think people are a little, like, shook by us at this point.
That's like, good!
I'm just like, do you know that I basically work from home, and I have this super minuscule budget, and I'm like...
You're like, puro rascuache, where you know, flying by the seat of your pants.
And they're like, who are your blah, 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 and what is your business? And I'm like,
what's
dude,
your business model, your strategy?
We are just, like, publishing.
It's like, here's the hat, drop a bucket.
Yeah,
there.
It's like, do you want to help or not? You know, like, there is no plan. I love this low pro Rasquatcha style. I don't think we need an office yet. We're not big enough.
That's rent you have to pay.
And that's rent you have to pay. And plus, offices get weird. Offices get politicky. People sleep with each other. It
can't
just
sit with us.
It just gets messy. Like, let's just work,
you know,
and let's just,
that's,
you know,
that's where I learned my lesson about not, like, messing around with coworkers when I was in the school newspaper.
Oh, really? There you go. Yeah, it's like you have to have, you know, your reputation really does precede you. I've always been of the mind that it's more important to be respected than it is to be loved.
Mm.
And I think I've, plenty of people hate me, but even the people that hate me, I would be safe to say, probably respect me.
And respecting your name.
And I think that that's an okay place to be. I really would encourage your listeners and your readers to, everyone is a journalist at heart because everyone has a cell phone. Everyone can document.
Yeah.
Everyone can say, this is what happened, when, where, and this is why, according to my research. And that is fundamentally what journalism is. And anyone can practice it with regard to the taquero got moved because the county came and...
Or, like, what happened recently, like, the taqueros are getting, like, robbed at gunpoint.
That's fucked up.
Yeah.
And, you know, we need to be aware when that happens, and we need to push our elected officials and our public safety officials to stop that, you know, and help stop that and try to protect our taqueros.
Bring attention to that.
And bring attention to that. You can't have a business... You're selling tacos, people are paying you cash... You are so obviously a target at the end of the night. And so that's, it's extremely dangerous. Someone could get killed. People have gotten killed. Taqueros have been shot in the face in this city. And I think it has to do with paying renta, like extortion, regular extortion style shit.
You know, it's always looks different than it was like every other year, but it's more or less like these same issues always come around.
Yeah.
So there you have it. If you're not already following them on social media, check out the channels on Twitter, Instagram at LATaco.com. I mean, that's the website.
At LA Taco.
The hashtag is LA Taco, simple enough. Find them on Facebook, just type in Los Angeles Taco. Follow them, like, you know.
Thanks a lot.
And if you know, you got something to contribute, hit up Daniel. Hit him up on, slide into the DMs, let them know.
Yeah.
They'll work with you. You know, it's not the LA Times, but tampoco, you know, they're not just throwing everything
pero
up
si
there.
Pero si te vas a pagar, eh?
yeah, that's the other thing, too. You know, for me, all these years I've been contributing to Taco for free because I love it. I love the space. You know, it gave me one of the first opportunities outside of my school newspaper to get published. So it's very personal to me, and I'm grateful that, you know, folks like Alex, like Hadley, everybody who's ever been part of, you know, the LA Taco family at one point or another have always supported each other. Everybody now kind of keeps touching in one way or another through social media. So
yeah,
it's really a genuine space. So, you know, for
me, it is a community, right?
Yeah, it was never about like, oh, I'm here to make money. I'm just like, no, I'm here because you're giving me the space and the time to tell what story that I want to share with everybody else.
Yeah.
So I'm happy to see that tradition is still going alive and well. And is there anything else you want to let folks know besides, you know, following LA Taco, keeping up?
I don't know. I mean, yeah, really, I'm glad, just glad to be here. And I'm, you know, I am very concerned about what's going on in Boyle Heights. And I think we want to keep covering that, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
We are watching these changes happen in these communities, and everyone is responding in their own way. And I think that there are good things happening and there are not good things happening, and then there are things that are gray that are happening that make you go, maybe this is a new thing that we should be doing.
Yeah.
So I'm very aware of the story of Boyle Heights, and we want to keep covering it in a good way and in a comprehensive way. But it's also a very big city, and we have to try and cover as much as we can. So I'm of the mind that we're all equal in this place, and we have to share it, and we have to, in the sense that we have to sort of share the overall city.
Mm-hmm.
But the kind of displacement that we're seeing is extremely alarming, and I don't think our representatives are doing enough to prevent the kind of violent, because it is real violence, displacement that is happening. So that is an issue we want to be on top of. So if you hear anything, if you think anything that should be covered, please let me know.
Let them know. Because my, you know, I know some council member who's all he's busy about is just making sure his wife is with them and tagging her on social media so people know that she's quote-unquote not running for city council.
You're talking about Jose Huizar's wife?
Yeah.
Come on. Yeah, I was, you know, wondering about that as well, you know.
It's
so
funny because, like, anytime he sees me, he's like, yo, what's up?
Huizar now?
Yeah.
I know, he's very, I don't know if you'll listen to this, but he's like, he knows who I am as well. Actually, he's a Berkeley grad as well.
Oh, yeah.
And he's very, like, they're all kind of nervous around.
Don't say anything. Just say hi. You know, take a pic for the Instagram.
I was like, yo, dude, like, ¿por qué estás nervioso? O sea, do you have something to hide, actually? You know,
yeah,
so.
Maybe another car accident?
Anyway. So, if you got any tips on the electeds, give me the juice, too.
There you go. So, you know, keep up with Daniel. He doesn't do it as much, but, you know, he still has a space at Intersections. LA Taco, of course. You know, go back to those Vice Munchies videos. You'll have a great time. Pick up his book, Down in Delirious in Mexico. I bought this for, like, the longest, and it was in my, like, to-read pile. But I was like, all right, like, I'm going to bring it so you can sign it.
Yes, I would love to sign it. Did you read it?
Not yet. I told you, it's in my to-read pile,
okay,
man.
I think you are going to enjoy
it's. I got to get through my stack.
As a piece of history now, I think you'll enjoy it.
I look forward to it. That's why I got it. Because I was like, you know what? I'm just going to get it now, and I'll read it later. But thanks, y'all, for listening.
Thank you, guys.
This has been episode 11 of Orale Boyle Heights, coming at you from Espacio 1839. We'll see y'all in a month.
Peace.